Today at Reader's Corner, Amor Towles, author of the best-selling novel, A Gentleman in Moscow. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Russia is certainly in the headlines these days, but for the next few minutes, we're setting aside talk of election meddling and diplomats to discuss a work of fiction. The novel, and it's a bestseller, is A Gentleman in Moscow, and it's written by today's guest, Amor Towles. A Gentleman in Moscow opens in the year 1922. Russia is in turmoil. Over less than two decades, Russians have suffered a world war, a civil war, two famines, and the so-called Red Terror. For what is perceived as anti-government sentiment, Count Alexander Rostov is confined to the Metropole Hotel across the street from the Kremlin in Moscow. While his world shrinks dramatically, one could argue that he gains far more than he loses. That's thanks in part to the people he meets there and the ways in which they impact his life. A Gentleman in Moscow was on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 40 weeks in hardcover, was named one of the best books of 2016 by the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the San Francisco Chronicle, and NPR. The book is being translated into over 20 languages, including Russian. Last summer, it was optioned for a television miniseries. Mr. Towles worked as an investment professional for over 20 years before penning his best-selling first novel, Rules of Civility, which was published in 2011. He now devotes himself full-time to writing, and he joins us today by Skype for this interview. Amor Towles, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, Amor, I'm going to start this off not so much about the book, but about you. And it involves a bit of a chip on my shoulder. It seems that everybody these days at university wants to major in business. And then they go on into the business world. Those of us who believe strongly in the role that the arts and humanities play in undergraduate education oftentimes worry that too many of our students are passing up quality educations in fields other than business, even if they're going into business. And probably one of my best examples of that is Carl Knapp, who works in the same city you do as an investment banker. He's one of our Rhodes Scholars, and he was an English major. And then he went, of course, to Cambridge, or Oxford, I should say. And then he did get his MBA from Harvard. So I want to talk about your educational background as a novelist. I see you have a master's in English from Stanford. I did not see what your major was in Yale, so if we could start there and then talk a little bit about how this gets you into the business world as an investment professional and how that gets you back again to the humanities and the business of being an author.
So the first thing I'd say is that I started writing fiction as a kid. So I wrote fiction in high school, and then I continued to write fiction when I was at Yale studying English. In answer to your question. And I wrote fiction at Stanford when I was there in graduate school. So I've been writing fiction my whole life. When I came to New York at the age of 25 after Stanford, I was looking for work, and a friend of mine had started his own investment firm. And I joined him as a research analyst. And 20 years later, we were still working side by side. So for my old friends, the surprise was really that I ended up in the investment business. You know, it wasn't that I ended up with a published novel. That was the thing that they were always expecting me to do. But in terms of your broader question, it's not uncommon today, or certainly wasn't uncommon 20 years ago or 40 or 50 years ago, to find someone with a humanities background in an investment environment. And in fact, probably from 1900 until 1990, the humanities backgrounds were probably the dominant supplier into the investment field. You know, you couldn't get a bachelor's degree in business for most of the 20th century. You certainly couldn't get a BA in investing. But investing as a career and as a profession is one which is research-based. It requires that analysts and portfolio managers be able to consider and investigate the world at large and changes which are taking place on a very large scale, politically, economically, demographically, globally. But at the same time, to be an effective investor or analyst, you need to be very good at studying micro details. You know, how is an individual product made, and how do the customers use it, and How do they value it? What are the people like who run a particular company? And are they effective at it? Do they have the right personality to excel? And sort of this ability to study sort of trends on a larger scale and analyze them, to study minutia with enthusiasm, and to synthesize the two towards making a judgment about the future. Ultimately, investing is a judgment about the future. The training of history or philosophy and literature too can be very good foundations for that practice. Because the other thing to keep in mind is that if you are an investment professional, you probably are doing a great deal of your work through interviewing. You are consuming written reports and historical data, but at the end of the day, you are also trying to get in front of a CEO, trying to get in front of a head of research, trying to get in front of a competitor, talk to them. And so many of the people who might have ended up as a journalist or as someone working as a consultant at McKinsey could just as well be an analyst. And again, the humanities background is a terrific one for that practice.
Now, by your statement there, I think you used the cutoff point of 1990, and I know there's probably nothing magical about that particular year. But I think what I hear you saying is that not so much anymore. It may be more difficult for someone like yourself to move into New York City and latch on to an investment firm without the MBA or without the business major. If that's the case, then I just ask the question, what's lost here? What's lost either in the larger world or what's lost in investment banking when all of a sudden there's not as many people like Amor Towles at the job?
I think, of course, I am speaking from my own background. So, you know, any listener should be appropriately skeptical about what I'm about to say. But yes, I do think that the investment world, but professional environments in general, benefit from having people with a humanities background without question. And I think we as a political population, and as a civil population, benefit from people having humanities background. I'm not saying that humanities background is the perfect or best background, but you certainly wouldn't want to suddenly evolve into a culture where everybody is, you know, studying economics and nothing else in the hopes of making a dime or a dollar. There's been plenty of research at this point which shows the ways in which, for instance, reading creates empathy. And by virtue of becoming involved in the reading of a novel, becoming interested in the lives of the characters, who are generally, we are attracted to reading books about people who lead different lives than ours. We don't spend our lives reading novels about people just like us. We do the opposite. And there's plenty of research which shows that very simple process of following the life of a different person in a novel, taking personally in a way their experience, attaching yourself to their experience, creates empathy. It builds that ability to be sympathetic and understanding to someone who's different, to being open to a different way of life, to a different set of ideas or ideals, to have the ability to consider our own prejudices, our own assumptions, and our own accomplishments in the context of a world with varied ways of life. And there's no question that this is essential to how we develop as individuals and to be productive citizens and family members and friends. So, yeah, I'm very much when I read that the humanities have dropped to some degree in terms of total enrollment across colleges across the country, I do think that's it's not a great thing for the country.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is Amor Towles, author of the New York Times bestseller, A Gentleman in Moscow. And by the way, just to add a little optimism to this discussion, the Chronicle of Higher Education reported just recently, it's actually a report from the University of Kentucky, that their English majors are on the increase there.
And, I'm glad to hear that, yeah.
Yeah, who knows what's attributed to that, but it's nice to know. Anyway, let's get on with the book. Tell us about your trip to Geneva, Switzerland, and the genesis of this book.
So when I was an investment professional, I ultimately served as a spokesperson for the firm. And as a result, I would spend a week in any given year in a hotel in Los Angeles and a week in a hotel in Chicago, a week in a hotel in London, meeting with our clients. And so one year when I was arriving at my hotel in Geneva for the eighth year in a row, as I was entering the hotel, I recognized some of the people who were lingering in the lobby from the year before. I mean, it was as if they had never left. And I thought to myself, God, you know, this is a nice hotel, but can you imagine if you actually had to live in it? And that was the genesis for this book. In the elevator on the way upstairs, I thought, you know, that's actually kind of an interesting idea for a story. A man is trapped in a hotel for a long period of time. And with that notion in the back of my mind, I went into my room, took out my hotel stationery, and began sketching an outline for a gentleman in Moscow. And right off the bat, I knew if I was going to tell a story in which the protagonist was trapped in a hotel for a long period of time, I knew that Russia would be a terrific venue, as it were, for my story, partly because Russia has a history of house arrest. It dates back, you know, hundreds of years in various forms, but also because Russia, you know, has been a fascination of mine. I love Russian literature. I'm fascinated by Russian culture. And Russia at the time of the revolution really represented, in the blink of an eye, a transition from sort of a 19th century European sensibility to a very forward-looking revolutionary avant-garde mindset, you know, which was on the day of the revolution, we are going to cast off all of these 19th century sensibilities that Russia has been based on, you know, for 100 years, and we are going to try to rapidly modernize and institute equal rights for women and to, you know, level the playing field economically. And obviously, there's a lot of negative things that came out, terrible things that came out of the Soviet era and all forms of oppression and violence to the citizenry. But taking a step back, as I say, as a moment in time, it provides this incredible case study of abandoning a century's sensibility and on the turn of a dime racing towards another century's group of sensibilities. And so that kind of made it an attractive backdrop for me to try to tell the tale.
Well, I must say, you're not the only one interested in Russia these days, as we all know. And I'd say your timing was pretty exquisite here. Obviously, you didn't time your book with all that's been going on in the last year or so, but it comes out at a time. You must, when you're at bookstores talking to patrons who are buying your book, you must hear the connection people draw between just one of the reasons why they might like to learn more about Russia and read your novel, no doubt.
You know what? That's actually not the case, really. Because you're right, as one who has traveled the country speaking to people about the book, and we live in an age where readers can send me emails on a daily basis contacting me through my website to tell me their thoughts about why they bought the book or how it affected them. The current political environment in Russia comes up never. I mean, literally never. So ironically, in a way, it's people are much more affected by what's going on in America, frankly, than that comes up more frequently than what's going on in Russia, which is, there's a portion of the American population that feels that their personal views of what matters in society or in their personal lives is out of step in a way with the leadership of the country. And so in a way, that's something that has intrigued them, is to read the story about someone who finds himself out of step with the direction that his country is going in, and trying to figure out how do you continue to move forward optimistically in a time like that. How do you continue to interpret your experiences and take actions that are consistent with your own values, even if your values now contrast to some degree the direction of the country? So I get much more comment from readers about their personal experience in America than I do about their interest in Russia. But even that said, I'm glad to say that the vast majority of people who talk to me about the book, what they value is something kind of even bigger than that, which is that it's a portrayal of an individual who is sort of is honorable, but who is fallible, who being stuck in the hotel for 30 years and having lost his possessions, lost his family, having watched as the country is uprooting what he values in Russian life, he has to, in the hotel, establish new relationships. He has to find new causes for happiness, however small, and he ultimately needs to find a new sense of purpose as an aristocrat who's lost his background. And I'm glad to say that I think most readers really attach to that, sort of this notion of that at any point in your life, under any set of circumstances, there is the opportunity to establish new friendships and to build a new family around you, to establish new lines of respect to find new opportunities for happiness, however small. And so, I'm glad to say that's really, I think, what the success of the book has been about. And, you know, if you went on Amazon.com or Goodreads and read the reviews of the book from citizens, you know, that's the sentiment that you would tend to find repeated most often.
So let's just take one quote to the point you're making here. And I don't even know where this quote comes from in your book, but it's precisely to your point. By the smallest of one's actions, one can restore some sense of order to the world. I mean, in a sense, those are the folks you're talking to at the bookstore who are telling you that, you know, I don't feel like my life is in order because something has changed dramatically in the United States of America and I don't know how to deal with it and I'm trying to get a grip on it. And here's a guy who's sentenced to one hotel for 30 years. Give us just a couple of examples of little things in this man's life. And if you could stay away from Nina and Sophia, because I'd like to talk about Sophia next. But if you could just give us a couple of examples in this man's life in the hotel that is about finding a way to bring purpose to your life, even in the smallest of ways, but important for being human and surviving.
First of all, I appreciate your pulling that sentence. Because, you know, as an author, I'm an outliner. So I know what's going to happen in every chapter. I know all the characters and their backgrounds. I know the settings of the various events and in very great detail before I start really writing chapter one. But there are discoveries as an author in the course of the book. You discover that the characters do things you didn't anticipate. But, you know, one of the things you discover is, you know, events happen that you didn't anticipate, but you'll discover some of the meaning of the book itself, the meaning of the lives. And that phrase was a late discovery for me. I mean, and it really came about, and I'm not going to give away much in talking about this, but, you know, that sentence comes about in a way as related to one of the characters seeing Casablanca as a movie. And the Russians did see American movies and enjoyed American movies. But what he notices that it, from the famous sort of scene at the early in Casablanca when Peter Lorre is arrested and they're chasing him and he fires at the local police and he's captured and dragged out of Rick's casino, that after this moment of mayhem, Rick, in essence, signals Sam, saying, you know, play the music again. He says to everybody, everything, you know, everything's okay now, everybody. You know, we're going to go back and have a nice time. And as he's walking through the cafe, he, just in passing, even as he's speaking, he takes a cocktail glass that was tipped over during the scuffle, and he sets it upright. And I had decided that Casablanca was going to be in the story, and it was going to play an important part in the story. And I was rewatching the opening minutes of Casablanca in sort of as I was revising the book in its final drafts. And even though I've seen Casablanca 100 times, for the first time I noticed that little moment. And that becomes this symbol for, in a way, for this character of the behavior of the Count and how he's led his life in the hotel. And one of the ways that I came to understand that myself, even though I had written it, I kind of realized at the end of the book that, and because I do believe this, that in uncivil times, an act of civility is itself, you know, an act of protest, of rebellion, you know, and you can't change the direction of history. You can't change the direction of a nation. In the case of the Count, you know, he has no hope of ending communism or, you know, bringing the czar back to life or reversing the advances of the 20th century. He's, you know, that's never going to happen. But what he can do is if he believes that people should behave in a certain way towards each other and should value certain timeless things, regardless of which decade or century you live in, regardless of what the political state is, if you do believe that, then you can defend those ideas. You can defend civility or honor or kindness or the love of joy and the desire to protect other people's ability to experience joy. You can defend those things, not with an army, but by your own personal actions. And as I say, I do believe that, and I feel more strongly about it having written the book, having kind of witnessed it through the behavior of my own character. And that occurs. I came to think of it as, in a way, as what I think of as the will to joy. And so, yes, this sort of little act of making a meal together under challenging times is another version of that small act of rebellion. Mm-hmm. And I'm going on too long about this maybe, but in the context of Russian history, it's been a very important dynamic. because both under the Tsar and in the Soviet era, today to some degree, but not anywhere near to the same degree, but in the Tsarist era, in the Soviet era, Russians were often asked to do things which went against their grain. And in the world where that was happening, the Russians, they preserved their dignity and their passions often in quiet little moments in private. You couldn't teach that poem anymore to your students safely. You would get in trouble if you did, but you could read it to your children at home in private. You weren't allowed to practice your religion, but you might gather in a basement to read from the Bible or the Torah or whatever your religion was in secret, in quiet. So you would pursue your art as best you could. You know, sometimes again, you know, making art that you weren't sharing. Novelists did that. You know, Solzhenitsyn was writing in private, and he would type up, and he had friends who would type up his work, and it would be shared secretly among a small group of people, hand by hand by hand, and decades in which that was the dominant way in which fine literature that was new was written and read. It was kind of in secret. So, yes, I think there's this natural instinct that even in these sort of overwhelming times to continue to pursue those universal passions, those universal truths, even in a small way, believing that if you do so, it will have an impact in the long run.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking with Amor Towles about his novel, A Gentleman in Moscow. So in the case of the Count, this is a gentleman who, throughout the book, gives us examples of how to deal with life daily when you're confined, as he was, to this hotel. But there's something very large that happens to this Count as this book goes on. And I don't want to give away all the book. Needless to say, we always save our novels for the reader and not the interview. But I do want you to talk about Nina and Sophia. And then I want to go to a page in your book where Nina asks the Count a very interesting question before she leaves him. But if you could set it up anyway so we know who these folks are.
Well, so if you think of it as, and again, I won't try to give away much for those who've not read the book, but the Count is, at the age of 30, is sentenced to house arrest in the hotel, and he spends 30 years there. And he kind of goes through a series of, he has an evolution in those 30 years. And it is really an evolution of purpose. Because as I said a few minutes ago, he starts out by losing his family, his possessions, and what he cares about in Russian life is being uprooted by the Soviets. And so he really feels at sea. He feels, in a way, he gets to a point where he's feeling trapped. He's feeling demoralized. He's coming to the conclusion that everything that he values is going to be gone and there will be no way to restore it. And, it's going to be discarded and he will be discarded with those values. That's kind of the state of mind he has. And the first change for the Count very early in the book is that he happens to meet a 9-year-old girl, Nina, who is also living in the hotel because her father is a member of the party. And she has a very different perspective on what it means to be living in the hotel. Like any good 9-year-old, she sees it as a rather exciting place to be. It's this intricate building that she can explore and navigate and, you know, and watch and spy and, you know, it's sort of filled with romance for her in terms of her imagination. And she becomes the Count's first friend in his new state under house arrest. And as I say, she kind of opens the door of rethinking what life in the hotel could be like. And this friendship then, kind of as she ages, continues. And you know, he kind of always remembers this as being the kind of the person who helped begin to change the way he thinks about things. Now, in the course of his life, he has, you know, a couple of evolutions, as I said, in terms of his sense of purpose, having been kind of a dilettante to some degree as a younger man, not exactly, but close to a dilettante, he gets frustrated enough in the hotel that he's got to do something. So he becomes a waiter in the fine restaurant in the hotel. And of course, the great irony here is that in the Soviet era, the aristocrat was the perfect waiter because the aristocrat was the one who had been raised in the appreciation of fine wine and food, had been raised in etiquette and to speak foreign languages. So the fallen noble is the perfect waiter in a fine restaurant. And that's what he becomes. And this is the beginning of kind of discovering for him how we can find purpose through work. You know, we've all been through that experience where, you know, you're a kid and suddenly you end up with your first job, and which seems a little scary and anxiety provoking from the outside. But once you're in that workplace, working in a kitchen or working, you know, the landscaping crew or with guys building a house for that first time, it's that witnessing the particular bond and friendships and the love of doing a good job and the pursuit of excellence in work in the workplace, the way in which we rely upon each other in the workplace. You know, it's a great pleasure to discover, and he kind of gets to discover that for the first time, having been a noble who had not needed to work. And later, he is asked to keep an eye on a 5-year-old girl, Sophia, and that kind of gives him his first glimpse of what it's like to be a parent. So as I say, you kind of go through these waves of finding new senses of purpose. You know, so yes, he has lost his aristocratic luxuries, but in exchange, he's been given the opportunity to discover the pleasures of working among a group in a restaurant, and then to discover the pleasures of having the responsibility for a young girl and what that means, and watching her evolve and come of age.
And then later, when she leaves, she says to him, "Do you ever regret coming back to Russia?" Because, of course, I don't know, you may have said it earlier in the interview, but obviously he was living somewhere else during the revolution and then chose to come back knowing that as an aristocrat he wasn't going to have a great life back in Russia. And she says, "Do you ever regret coming back?" And I'm going to quote your work here because it's just so beautifully said. "Well, since the day I was born, Sophia, there was only one time when life needed me to be in a particular place at a particular time. And that was when your mother brought you to the lobby of the Metropole. And I would not accept the czarship of all the Russias in exchange for being in this hotel at that hour." Congratulations on that line. That's really great stuff, I think. And I think it really does tell the tale of a guy who is a bachelor all of his life, and all of a sudden he has to raise this little girl and deal with all kinds of challenges, including trying to explain to her the intricacies of life from the feminine standpoint. And again, great insight you have as an author and a novelist.
Well, thank you. You know, but I'll say something. But while I'll accept the compliment, I will qualify my acceptance of the compliment, which is to say that when readers come up to me and they say, I have this particular sentence that I thought was insightful, or I wrote it down, or I underlined it, almost all the time, including the sentences that you've quoted today, almost all the time, those insights or the way those phrases are put, I would never have had those insights as an individual living my own life. You know, it's not the kind of thing that would occur to me to say to my children over dinner or to my siblings or to somebody that I had worked with in the past, what have you. Almost always what those phrases are the product of the writing process itself. Because what's happened is that as the author, I am trying to see the world through the point of view of a different person, a person with a very different background than mine, a very different set of circumstances, and a very different personality. Now, I'm sort of stepping into that person's life, into the way they see the world, and then something happens to them that has never happened to me. And suddenly, kind of as you're writing, if it's going well, you've taught this other person with this other background and this other personality who's in this circumstance you've never been in, and they're the person who suddenly says, da-da-da-da-da, and it rolls off their tongue, you know, because they, given their background, given their set of circumstances, they have an insight about the world or about life. And often when I'm writing that, I'm like, "Oh, that's a good one. You know, well done, counter." Almost as if they just said it to me out loud. And so as I say, I appreciate the compliment, but I qualify my acceptance because it certainly doesn't reflect the fact that I am kind of wise and good at that sort of thing on a daily basis. On the contrary, it's you know, those insights are very much the product of the narrative process.
Well, all I know, Amor, is that if I sat down in your office at that point in your novel or any other time in your novel, trust me, those words would not have come from those people. And that's because they came from you. And that's why you're the best-selling novelist of the book, A Gentleman in Moscow, by Amor Towles. Also, pick up a copy of Rules of Civility, another great work, his first novel. Amor, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. This has been a real delight.
Bob, thanks for having me.
Next week, Lenora Chu, author of Little Soldiers, An American Boy, A Chinese School, and The Global Race to Achieve. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.